This is the Popmatic Podcast for July 30th, 2014.
We all love Big Brother.
We all love Big Brother.
The TV show, because this is a pop culture podcast.
Woo-hoo.
Yay, CBS.
It's the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. Joining me on this episode are...
Amanda.
Bill.
Greg.
Bill. Greg, Bill.
And I am Brian. I think this is the first time we've actually had this particular configuration of podcasters.
You could be right.
Remember that nightmare you couldn't wake up from? That's exactly what this podcast is.
Wait, why am I here then?
On this episode, we feature our favorite dystopias, as oxymoronic as that is, the places that are exactly how we don't want them to be. So why are we doing this today? So the film version of The Giver is coming out, and The Giver has kind of become a contemporary classic. It's on a lot of school reading lists. You know, it really has become one of the most beloved dystopian novels of the last few years. Beloved dystopian, that's an oxymoron.
It's a thinker. Beautiful. It's a thinker.
Has anyone read The Giver?
No.
Yeah.
Went to the worst school ever. I
read it as an adult.
I read it as an adult, too. I enjoyed it. It was good. I think I understood the big central metaphor. What it's about is there's no pain in the society. It's like a utopia. But what you find out is like one person gets picked and they take all the pain.
Oh, I suck.
And then a little girl is like.
Of course, a little girl.
That's BS.
Yeah.
And then she. So she's like, glad it's not me. I want to go play Pokemon.
From great suffering, great pain, came a solution. Communities, where disorder became harmony.
The way things look and the way things are very different.
What do you think would happen if you skipped your morning injection?
I cannot prepare you for what's going to happen.
There's something missing from our lives. Something that has been stolen.
When people have the freedom to choose, they choose wrong.
So the film version of The Giver is coming out August 15th. And Mike loves science fiction. He loves dystopias. He was so excited about this episode, but he's not here today. Mike's kind of become my rock, so you guys need to pull through on this episode.
Should I talk really low like Mike does?
You know what? The movie that Mike was real excited about on last week's show has been held over at the Bell Court. Might not be there when this posts, but it's a dystopian movie, too, about a dystopian future. And, you know, it's connected with the film version of The Giver because Marco Beltrami did the music for both movies. And when I saw the trailer for The Giver, you know what I thought? Well, at least the music's good. No, it looked fine, but the music was really cool. And I read that Taylor Swift is in The Giver, but I didn't see her in the trailer.
He's a better agent.
Do you guys know anything about that?
I have not heard anything.
I know she's in it.
But the movie that you're talking about is it Snowcatcher? I'm not really hip to the Snowpiercer.
Forgive me. Taylor Swift is in The Giver, and a bunch of other famous people are in the Snowpiercer.
And that's the one at the Bell Court.
That's the one that's at the Bell Court, but the week now when we're recording. When this posts, and next week, it might not be there. But it might. It's getting really, really good reviews.
Then you have or have not seen it, Bill?
I have seen it. Highly recommend it. It's very visual, and it should be seen on the big screen, like Stephen King said on his Twitter account.
So, Bill, what's a dystopia?
By definition, dystopia is a community or society that in some important way undesirable or frightening. It is the opposite of utopia. Such societies appear in many artistic works, particularly in stories set in the future. Brian.
And dystopias seem to be in vogue. It seems like there's just a lot of books that are dystopian now, even outside of science fiction. And I just had this thought that, you know, maybe it's because we're on the cusp of something with, like, the Internet of Things. I think things are really changing. I think privacy is changing. Like, we're, like, way more connected than we ever were before. We're, like, actually in the midst of a technological revolution. And maybe this has something to do with how many dystopian novels and works of fiction that there are. Now, like I said, dystopias have always been the hallmark of science fiction, but they seem to have a certain literary cachet. A while back, I did a quick list on the Off the Shelf blog, and here's what I mentioned. Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi. 10th of December by George Sanders. Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Scheitengart. And Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. That's like a roundup of like the one of like the hottest, most critically acclaimed books, you know, the last couple years.
And authors.
I just wanted to put that out there. But first, Amanda.
So it seems, I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, dystopians, and Brian's list was mostly adult dystopias, but all the movies seem to come from young adult land or YA land. And that's where my story takes place. I tend to get buried in series, and I kind of wanted something that was just going to be a standalone. It was a one-shot wonder. I just wanted to enjoy it and move on. Well, it's a series. It's going to be a trilogy, like everything else in the world. It's called Fire and Flood. It's by Victoria Scott. And the basic premise, it's set in modern-day U.S., maybe a little bit in the future, but it's pretty current. People are getting sick, and nobody really knows why. And so our main character, Tella, is 16. She and her family, her brother's ill with this mysterious terminal illness, and so they moved to Montana to try to fix it and see if the fresh air will make him better and whatnot. Well, while they're there, Tella gets this mysterious invitation that her parents try to hide from her and to join what's called the Brimstone Bleed. Well, she doesn't really know what that is, but the premise is if she wins this event, whatever this mysterious event is, her brother will be cured of this illness. So, like, the first 50 so pages, there's a lot of, like, nothing's really explained until you kind of read through it. So the Brimstone Bleed is an epic race across jungle, desert, ocean, and mountains. So you have to go out. It's kind of like the Amazing Race, but fighting for a cure, and there are like hundreds of people, and then the person that wins gets the cure for their terminally ill person, relative, friend, whoever they're doing this for, and so they get to be mysteriously cured. They'll be fine. They'll all live happily ever after. The problem is this race is very violent. People tend to die throughout these events, and then here comes the Hunger Games part where they're, you know, out in the wilderness. And this one, she added the thing that they pick up an egg at some point, which just kind of reminds me of Aragorn, where he gets this magic dragon egg. And so the egg hatches, and then everybody gets their own, like, little animal help. Like, some people get a lion, and the lion has like, can breathe fire, and so then you can have fire at night. Tella actually gets a fox, and for the first part of the book, you don't know what the fox is, and I'm not going to spoil it for you, but he has some special powers that makes him very valuable. So this book was really interesting. Like, it really pulled me in and made me want to keep reading it. And now I'm kind of mad because I have to wait for the second book, which is going to be called Salt and Stone, and it's going to be out in February of 2015. But it was very interesting. I like this one better than The Hunger Games. I think it wasn't quite as sadistic. I would like to ask the world, where do these sadistic adults keep coming from, and why do we let them torture our youth? It just seems to be like that's the big theme. And for those of you who think that Victoria Scott's name sounds familiar, she also wrote the Dante Walker series, which I haven't read, but I've heard is really popular. I've heard of it, I just haven't read it. So that was Fire and Flood by Victoria Scott.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much is it like The Hunger Games?
8.75. Most of the reviews, like on Goodreads, compare it to, they say you take Hunger Games and Digimon and put them together, and that's where she got this from.
You know what it kind of sounded like to me? What was the Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy? What was the first one called? The Golden Compass?
Yeah.
It sounded like The Golden Compass and The Hunger Games together.
It was. I mean, it's definitely derivative, but it was enjoyable.
Well, you know what I've realized about young adult novels? Mm-hmm. That's a marketing tool by publishers. That's not necessarily like how readers read.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Craig.
How did you think it compared to Divergent in terms of enjoyability and writing style?
I would put it on the same level because there is some big conspiracy because by the end of the book we're trying to figure out why everybody's sick and are we going to bring down the government, which that's kind of where Divergent ended up too. I enjoyed Divergent and I would put this on the same level.
All right, so there's a lot of dystopian classics out there, but I wanted to talk about one that came out at the top of 2014 by an author who is typically considered a writer of literary fiction, but he's by no means the first literary author to take his hand at this genre. His latest, called On Such a Full Sea, did I ever say what his name is? His name is Chang Rayleigh. his latest, called On Such a Full Sea, picks up X number of years in the future after American society has become a wasteland and Chinese immigrants have taken over in what becomes known as the New China. This book tells the story of Fan, a pint-sized girl who one day does the unthinkable and walks out the gate of her settlement, built on the ruins of Baltimore, now called Bmore, because in the future they apparently use the same lingo as they do on HBO's The Wire. She leaves in search of her boyfriend, Reg, who has suddenly gone missing, but this is a little bit of a plot device to get her out into the greater world and show the different strata of people that occupy it. There's basically three strata. At the top, there's the charter, or the sort of gated golf course communities where you need permission to paint your house. Then there's the production facilities or settlements that farm disease-free fish and vegetables for the charters. And Bmore is emphasized here, but presumably there are others built on the ruins of fallen post-industrial American cities. And third are the counties, or the land beyond the walls of the charters and the facilities. So one aspect that I think works really well is that the story is told in the plural, or the collective voice, by unnamed residents of Bmore, as if they're recounting a myth. So it's we, the people of Bmore, referring to our fan, and it suggests a sort of group mentality about these facilities people, and it becomes very effective whenever Fan's in danger. I know for me this book struck a chord, having lived in China. There's just so much about it that is familiar. And from an American perspective, parts of China are remarkably like a modern-day dystopia. I know that Chang Rayleigh visited the city of Shenzhen prior to writing this book, hoping to do some more journalistic work. And I think a lot of that research ended up in the book. Shenzhen, if you don't know, is where everything you own comes from. It's called the Overnight City because there was literally nothing there 20 years ago. It's home to Foxconn, most famously, which is the giant complex that makes most of the Apple products. And, you know, people live there and hardly ever see the light of day. Suicides are not uncommon. And in Shenzhen and all throughout China are these sorts of settlement towns that crop up around a particular factory. So I think that he's playing off of these real settlements in China, and I think he's also playing off the idea of the dying industrial towns in America, a la Detroit. There are certainly parts of Baltimore that would fit that pattern as well. And I think he's playing off of American anxiety about a Chinese takeover. If you guys have that or not, it seems to crop up when I talk to people about China a lot.
There's different kinds of domination, right? And I think that they're already there in one way.
Mm-hmm. So overall, he does a great job of blending Chinese and American culture, subtly breaks a lot of the molds of the dystopian genre as well. So I was entranced the whole time, and I recommend On Such a Full Sea.
Does it have a happy ending?
Don't
answer that.
It's a dystopia.
Is it like opera?
It has an ending.
We had just mentioned in passing Little Brother by Cory Doctorow, but another one of dystopian novels that he wrote, or arguably dystopian, is he wrote a novel called For the Win, and it was about Chinese gamers, Chinese gold miners, like in multiple player online games like World of Warcraft. They form a labor union, or at least try to. Like, that's what the story is. It was definitely the best story of Cory Doctorow's that I've read. It was interesting because, much like yourself, Doctorow is he's a Sinophile. I think he thinks a lot about China and considers the relationship between the United States and China a lot.
That's cool. I haven't read that one, but I think that people of China could definitely benefit from the X-Net. Something like it.
Anyway. Because when you want your geopolitical news, you come to the Popmatic podcast.
I do every day.
Popmatic.
And now Bill has an update on the hole in Siberia.
Well, no.
Oh, sorry.
Close.
I was going to... two of my favorite books about dystopian societies are Alpha Centauri or Die by Lee Brackett, Logan's Run by George Clayton Johnson, and William F. Nolan.
You got to send me links to all those.
However... we don't have those two books.
Ah, dope.
But I have to give them a shout out because I really enjoy them. The book I'm recommending is I Am Legend by the late, great Richard Matheson. I Am Legend could be considered more apocalyptic fiction. It deals with Robert Neville, a sole survivor after a worldwide disease which causes other survivors to be turned into vampires. Matheson's 1954 novella is famous for taking the vampire out of Transylvania and putting them in the heartland America. It's been a major influence on both Stephen King and Dean Koontz. Director George Romero confessed he ripped off the book when he made Night of the Living Dead, which begat the comic and TV show The Walking Dead. The book I Am Legend has made an major influence on speculative fiction. If you have not read it, now is the time to seek it out. Also, last night on demand, I didn't even know this show was on. It's on Lifetime. It's called The Lottery. And it's based on the book by P.D. James, The Children of Men. And it's dealing with a dystopian society. Just watched the first episode. I enjoyed it. I really, I have to watch a few more episodes to get a vibe from it. But I am going to watch it because I did enjoy the first episode. It does have a science fiction feel to it.
So, I Am Legend, is that the Will Smith movie they
That
made?
Is based on it. There hasn't really been a good movie.
Did they do Omega Man, too?
Omega Man, yeah. And then they did another I Am, The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price. Right. They've made it three times, and they've never done it right. Except for Night of the Living Dead, which Matheson said that was the closest one to getting it correct. And he said, even though it was ripped off.
And that's a popular TV show.
Yes.
That I can't watch.
And The Lottery, a TV show, there's been a movie made of that book, The Children of Men, actually a critically acclaimed movie.
The classic one, right. Like maybe
The Children of Men.
20 years ago?
No, it was, it wasn't too long.
So you say Children of Men?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about something else.
You thought I was talking about the Shirley Jackson novel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we could include, too. But, no, I was thinking about the P.D. James novel Children of Men was made into a film with starring Clive Owen. Who directed that?
I think he just won the Oscar.
Yeah.
Alfred.
It's the guy that did Gravity.
Gravity.
Yeah. It was, he did that. It was one of his movies he made before Gravity.
It's kind of funny Universal didn't want to release it because of the dystopian society. And then there was kind of an uproar about, people wanted to see this movie. When they released it, it became the number one money maker in the country. And then they thought, oh, gee, we screwed up there. But it was one of those kind of strange, offbeat films that kind of caught on.
So was it like the last child that was born or something?
Yeah, Yeah, well, I mean, because of disease, women could no longer become pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so children, there was no children, so people gave up hope. And he did a very good job of visualizing in that movie. I don't know if the library has it, but the dystopian society.
Yeah, it was good. I remember.
Fantastic cast in that movie.
I just remember that creepy kid is on the computer. So, arguably, all these dystopias are just symbolic representations of our society now, right? I mean, that's how it works, right? It's commentary about how our society is. So I'm going to talk about a nonfiction book called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age by Astra Taylor. What she's writing about is the internet and how the internet is supposed to be this great liberating force where everyone has a voice and everything is crowdsourced and everything is free. And just as basically as that's not true, and that a lot of people make a lot of money off the internet. And what happens is that not only creative types, but just regular people create the content and then other people get the money. And that's what it's about. Of course, we all know about musicians. Even if you're on a major label, you get paid less from streaming digital rights than you do from album sales. And she also talked about the collapse of newspapers, how supposedly all the news is on the internet, and actually when they do academic studies, only 12% of actual news that's published is actually real reporting, and all the other stuff is just press releases recycled over and over. And she has, there's statistics about how staff at, actual traditional institutions of journalism, like print newspapers, have shrunk, but their actual number of articles has exploded.
So, like, how is that possible? It's because they're actually not writing anything. Mm-hmm. And these, this is also something that I've heard people complain about with The Tennessean in recent years. It was cool. It was thought-provoking and somewhat dystopian. I had some issues with some of the things that she said, you know, but it was a short book that made me think about a lot of things. And actually, this is her first book. Before she was a filmmaker, she made a movie called The Examined Life that was about philosophy in the modern age. And it was basically a series of vignettes where philosophers would talk about a specific subject. It's kind of like that movie Waking Life, but with real people and not animated. So check out The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age by Astra Taylor in her film The Examined Life. It was good stuff.
I think it's interesting because I'm going back now and we're watching Superman, the Lois and Clark from the 90s, and it's set in a newsroom, and there's all, and I just wonder how many newsrooms are left like that. I mean, because this, you know, newspapers have gone, you know, it's 20 years old, so newspapers have completely shrunk and changed. And like, I was reading something and they said that newspapers weren't even, like, newsrooms weren't even going to exist in the future, like the way they are now. So like kids growing up won't even know what a newsroom is.
Pretty interesting documentary about that. And how it relates to New York Times is the mm-hmm. Page One documentary. Anybody see? We have it at the library, but it just basically says the same thing that you actually watch New York Times newsroom shrink like throughout the documentary as people are let go, people that have been there and built that institution, and they hire like a couple of new media guys that replace.
They can pull stuff off the AP.
Yes, that's exactly what she's writing about, but. But since we're talking about it, I'll bring up like one of the kind of issues I had in the book. She talked about how in previous decades, like pre-internet, even the serious journalism and reporting that was in newspapers was never what made the money. It was always ads and comics and coupons, right? The fluff, right? And then that basically made the money so you actually could do things that had social import.
I believe that.
But that is exactly the same model that fuels online websites now, only she doesn't make that connection. And she, one of the examples of a bad website that she talks about that isn't really news is Gawker. But she talked about how, like, Gawker has all these, like, sleazy stories and celebrity stories and stuff. And then every once in a while, they do kind of have what you would call traditional journalism, like muckraking, that kind of thing. And I would argue, but that economic model that worked for old newspapers still works for websites. And the same thing that sort of the opposite of what happened with the New York Times has actually happened with Gawker. It started, it was just a gossip site. It got all kinds of money because people went there just for crap. And now, because it gets so many hits and they have so much money, they actually can do good reporting, and they do good reporting sometimes on Gawker, right? And so that is one of my beefs, is that the economic model is actually the same, only the medium is different. Now, I'm not going to make a qualitative judgment about, like, say, like the reporting in a, like a feature-length investigative story on Gawker as opposed to the New York Times. But obviously, sometimes the New York Times gets things wrong.
Were you left with the feeling of like what you can do as a consumer or to help counter whatever the problems are? A lot of times I feel like I read those books and I'm just like, oh, this is the problem. Now what?
I only have very personal answers to that.
But in terms of the book.
Well, actually, I didn't get to the end.
The truth comes out.
Right? I'm right in the middle. Right? And it seemed like it was perfect for this podcast. So I don't know how she concludes. But so far, like one of the chapters was about music, and then one of the chapters was about journalism. And at the end of those chapters, she didn't have, like, we should do this, or, you know. So I could just say for myself, whenever I can, I try to buy direct from artists. Like, if there's some way, like, with music anyway, if there's some way I can support an artist that I like, I would figure out, you know, how to, like, buy direct from them.
Mm-hmm. Or you can always stream them on Spotify and then mail them $1, which is way more than they'd make.
Well, this is the other thing that she kind of criticizes. And like, the media pundits say, well, this is how you do it now. Well, like, I love music, and that's not how I do it. And I guess I'm speaking about streaming. Like, I don't use any streaming service at all. Like, I don't listen to music that way. I buy records at the record store. That's just me. Yeah. But then the pundits are like, no, that's not how it is. This is the new paradigm.
I mean, I almost use this for, like, discovery. You know, if I want to try and expose something new to myself, then I will stream it or get it on Hoopla. But then if I really like it, I'll go out and buy it.
You're old because you called it records.
Well, you actually are buying records, right?
Are you buying them on vinyl?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
No, well, both. I mean, it depends. I mean, I don't buy CDs anymore, but so I'm buying digitally or vinyl. And vinyl sales have gone up.
They have, for the past.
And prices have come a little bit down, too.
Yeah. Which is weird. Same thing's going to happen with books soon. Greg, what's tickling your fancy this week?
Well, Brian, I wanted to talk about a relatively new art space that is not brand new, maybe, but it's new to me. It's called Oz, and it's located in sort of northwest Nashville, in the old CAO cigar factory. It takes its name from the owner, Tim Ozgener, who is the former owner of CAO. Ozgener is a Turkish-Armenian with a background in engineering who established himself as an importer of fine humidors and Turkish pipes and cigars. But after a battle with cancer, he decided that art was really what made him happy. His goal is to bring in a lot of different types of art to Nashville that we may not be exposed to. He finds artists whose work he believes in, and he uses his engineering know-how to help bring their ideas into action. We currently have two library puppeteers from Wishing Chair that are helping to workshop a piece that incorporates puppets, masks, and modern dance. But it's also a gallery, performance space for musicians, there are humidors on display, and Ozgener is something of a painter as well. He has synesthesia, which for him means that he has a blurring of the perception of numbers and colors, and he has a series relating to his experience with that on display. Yeah, check it out at oznashville.com. I think Amanda might have something to say about that. I'm totally in the dark about what
that is. I just wanted to say that this gives a whole new meaning to paint by number, but okay. Ah.
It does. So yes. I actually had my wedding reception at Oz, and it was an awesome place. And they hadn't even officially opened it yet. They were just kind of they actually redid it the whole summer before I got married last November. And Mr. Ozgener has a fascination with pi. The number pi, like 3.1415.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, all over this place, he has different installations of artworks based on colors and pi and how they relate. And it's very cool. He has one place in the office on the wall that he's got, like, different lengths of wood that correspond to units of measure in numbers of pi that are all different colors. And we called it the pi wall. Mm-hmm. And, like, we wanted to have – I don't think we ended up doing it. I think we forgot. We wanted to have our wedding picture taken there with him.
Did he serve pie?
He did not serve pie. Mm. But – and they also had, like, little handouts for all our guests that had, like, an art thing that they could color that was about pie and their relationship with synesthesia. And so that was really cool. And it's a great space. It takes forever to get there. It's out in the middle of nowhere, and you have to drive by the prison. But it is a great space. And if you have the chance to go to Oz, it's definitely worth the walk down the yellow brick road to get there.
I thought I was booking Oz for my wedding reception, but we ended up having it at the prison, and it was an entirely different experience.
Didn't the barbed wire throw you off?
Oh, you know?
The best part about...
I'm goth. I don't know.
The one I did like about Oz, they do have an artist in residence, and I can't remember his name, but they have a big statue of Bacchus, who's, you know, the god of revelry and wine, and he oversaw all our festivities, and it was very lovely. And then it was in the paper, like, the next Monday after I got married as a venue, so...
You had a bacchanal at your wedding.
I did have a bacchanal. My mom had no idea what that was. But we educated her. So.
Excellent. That's awesome.
My dad knew who it was. She's like, what is that? Who's that? What's that big guy? Is it like Poseidon or something? I'm like, no, honey, that's Bacchus. So I want to talk about MasterChef on Fox. We always talk about the Food Network and all the great shows on that channel. And I will admit that I am late to the party on this one because MasterChef originally debuted in the UK in 1990. And so 24 years later, I decided I maybe should watch an episode. And so it's on Fox and it stars Gordon Ramsay and two other guys, Joe Bastianich and Graham Elliott, who Joe owns a winery and Graham is a chef, as the judges, and they feature home cooks. And this is the fifth season that it's been on in the U.S., and it's actually on in 40 countries, which I find mind-blowing that this one TV show is in 40 different countries. But I've been watching it, and I kind of got drawn in. It's very – I feel like it's a lot more dramatic than the Food Network shows. Like, they kind of stage it to create conflict and drama, and there's this whole battle between this 18-year-old girl called Iran and this, like, 50-year-old stay-at-home dad from Malibu called Leslie, and they pick at each other the whole time. And My two favorites right now, there's a great big guy called Willie, who he's the church music director, and he is just, he's just the funnest guy. He's very calm, and he's, you know, he's a really good cook. And then there's a girl who reminds me of Amy Farrah Fowler called Jamie, and she hasn't really been in much of the forefront of the drama, but she's always a really good cook, and she does a good job, and her name is Jamie. And so right now I'm rooting for Willie and Jamie, and we will see all the rest of the drama that happens, and hopefully one of my two picks will win. I have no idea when it's on. I watch it on demand. But I know it's on Fox.
These are totally amateur chefs.
They've done some versions for professionals, but the one, just MasterChef itself, is for home cooks.
So it's a misnomer.
Yes. To think, to dystopia.
Basically.
Did you see Billy Bob Thornton video of him complaining about Cupcake Wars?
I didn't, but now I'm totally want to watch that. That would be awesome.
Well, he was talking about that we live in a dystopian society, and it's sad that we're going to have a show about cupcakes, but it has to be a competition where people fight each other.
We're living in a time that's just become judgmental, and everybody wants to see failure. They want to see people knocked off the hill. You can't have a television show without a competition because they want to see who cries this week and who goes downhill, who gets kicked out. We don't need one show about cupcakes, as far as I'm concerned. But you know what? If you got one, okay, that's fine. Let's have a show about cupcakes. But does it have to be a competition? Do you have to have cupcake wars?
So, I think it's okay. Who makes a better cupcake? Who's the better chef?
I've watched Cupcake Wars. It's all good.
You know, 40 countries makes sense because everybody eats, right?
Yeah, and that food seems to be the big international blender.
Whoever owns the rights to that show has on to something, because that's very potable, right?
Yes, you
can do it in Antarctica.
Well, it was like, I was looking at the list, it was like MasterChef Bangladesh and MasterChef India, and all these different places, so everybody eats. All right, Mr. Bill.
Okay, tickling my fancy is a DVD called With Great Power, The Stan Lee Story. Now, for those of you who are going, who's Stan Lee, first question, where have you been? Stan Lee is an American comic book writer, and among his creations are The Avengers, The Fantastic Four, The Hulk, Spider-Man, Thor, X-Men. With Great Power, the Stan Lee story is a good deal of fun. It accounts the rise of this pop culture legend. The DVD is loaded with extras. I'll just say it. It's the feel-good documentary of the year. So tickling my fancy is With Great Power, the Stan Lee story. And would you like to hear my Stan Lee story?
I would love to hear Stan Lee's story.
Was it at Comic-Con?
Yeah, I was at Comic-Con. And I was getting on the elevator, and around the corner walked Stan Lee. So I was Mr. Cool. I didn't say anything. And we get on the elevator, and these two girls are on there, and they just start to giggle the entire way down to the lobby. And he goes, well, what's so funny? And they just go, can we have your picture? And he said, well, of course. And so the thing of the documentary, it paints him to be a good guy, but he is a good guy. I mean, I witnessed that. He could have said, no, get lost. But he really enjoys what he does. He's like 93, still agile. And it's just a fun documentary. It's got loads of extra. And so the final word is excelsior. Brian, to you.
I wanted to say that not only did he create a lot of the Marvel superheroes that we all know, but he was one of the first people to actually put long-form narrative personalities into superheroes in comics, and then also deal with social issues too. His influence on culture is hard to underestimate.
Yeah, he's dealt with that documentary, dealt with that, and Kevin Smith calls him the Walt Disney of our era, which is probably accurate. Yeah.
Did he ever create a female character?
I'm sure he did. Yeah, the documentary lists everything he did on one of the extras, so you can go down and see. So, yeah, Fantastic Four, I'm sure.
Jean Grey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm in a standalone, but.
What?
It was a different time, I understand.
What? Oh, yeah, in the 70s, he was a machismo pig, but.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But he did create, the Black Panthers, and there were a few others that he did create. And the Silver Surfer had great connotations during the 60s, which I didn't realize.
I don't know those connotations.
Yeah, 60s, because the Silver Surfer was all about saving the environment. And so it made me want to go back and find some of the Silver Surfers and just read those, because I was not a Silver Surfer dude.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even the whole sort of indie comics renaissance that tells, narrative stories over time,
If he didn't do that with his superheroes, I don't think non-superhero artists would be doing that right now. Anyway, I said that already. Excelsior!
Excelsior!
So, on the last week's show, I asked if you wanted me to talk about pornography or copyright, and Bill and Mike both shouted in unison, pornography.
I voted for copyright.
Just for the record, and Amanda said copyright, which I'm not going
to... I'm a nerd, okay?
Okay. Hey, I can talk to you about copyright all day. And I'm not going to draw any conclusions about that, right? But Amanda's thinking about the stuff that matters. On this week's show, I can talk about video games or I can talk about music.
What about video game music?
I can do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
No.
Right? Okay.
I don't want to get called out next.
So what's tickling my fancy is a video game called Shadowrun Returns. It's a science fantasy turn-based tactical role-playing game in dystopian cyberpunk Seattle. That's how it relates to the theme.
Isn't that just like normal Seattle?
No, it's like set in the future and there are trolls.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
So.
It's 2054 and the world has changed. Gone to hell, more like. It started when magic came back. The awakening, some call it. You're rubbing elbows with orcs, elves, even trolls these days. Meanwhile, megacorps bleed the world dry, one board meeting at a time. They own just about everything. But not us. We're Shadowrunners. Mercenaries operating in the margins, working dangerous jobs for the desperate and the powerful. Being a runner takes more than skill and street smarts. If you want to live long enough to get paid, you'll need a team, the right talent for the job. Maybe that's a mage, someone who can fry your enemies with deadly spells. A good decker can jack into the Matrix and bypass the toughest security without leaving a trace. Adepts, riggers, shaman. Get your street samurai. Packing enough firepower and cyberware to take on a small army. Man, magic, and machine. Takes it all to survive in the shadows. Welcome to the sprawl.
You know, it's cyberpunk, so it's kind of like the Matrix or whatever, but the twist is there's been like this cosmic event and magic has returned and half the human race has transformed into elves, orcs, dwarves, or trolls. So it's like science fantasy and it's tactical turn-based in the sense that it's like old school. So the action doesn't happen in real time. Like as your character gets builds and you get different equipment and spells and things, each person takes a turn and you have to use strategery to win the battles. And it's like 2D and top down and it's text based. It's very old school. Yeah. And one of the things I think that they're trying to do is replicate the tabletop role playing game experience because Shadowrun was originally a tabletop role playing game. And this is a big year for sort of the Shadowrun franchise because Shadowrun 5th edition of the role-playing game was...
This is the tabletop.
This is the tabletop okay. role-playing game Shadowrun that Shadowrun Returns is based on. The 5th edition of the role-playing game just came out this year to a lot of acclaim. It was nominated for the Annie Award for the Best Product of the Year, and the Annie Awards won't be until... later in August. That's like one of the big gaming awards. It takes place at Gen Con in Indianapolis, the biggest gaming convention in the world. And then it was nominated, but it didn't win for the Origin Award for Best Role-Playing Game. But the person that designed Shadowrun, Jason Weissman, he actually helped design the Shadowrun Returns video game. So the feel is there and it's all the same. And of course, ironically, I'm a gamer without a gaming group, so I'm playing Shadowrun Returns on the computer, and I'm really liking it. And to talk about video game music, I got Shadowrun Returns on Steam, which you can actually play cool new video games on Linux now, thanks to Steam. And, you know, for a few more dollars, I got the soundtracks to the Shadowrun Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis games. You got to download them if you paid a little bit more. So yeah, Shadowrun Returns. I'm liking it.
Do you know who wrote those? The music on those?
I don't know.
I don't either.
Because I can download them. Maybe I haven't yet. So that's what's tickling my fancy.
How do the cyberpunk elements come into play? Is it just like a visual element?
Like you get like nanotechnology things like bolted into your character, and then you can hack into computer systems. And then when you choose your character class, you can either choose to be more of a computer hacker or more of a magic user. But then there's everything in between. I think what they've tried to do is really mimic the role-playing game as much as possible. So there are these sort of character archetypes, or you can just be a custom character. And I think that because the gameplay is so throwback, it's really all about as the story moves along, or like you move through the story, whether you're smart enough to manage your resources in such a way and build your character in such a way that you can overcome the combat once the fighting starts. It's isometric, right? It's, so it looks 3D, but it's like 2D top down. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with those kind of video games, I think gamers know what I mean, like Diablo, if you're familiar with that game. And it's very like hyper detailed. So the idea is to make the world of Shadowrun, which was a big deal for a gamer of a certain generation, a tabletop role playing gamer of a certain generation. Shadowrun is a really big deal. So the world is really super detailed, and it's, I mean, that's the best way to explain it, is like specific Northwest cyberpunk on acid.
And you don't have to use the powers of your imagination. It's all there for the taking.
It's been fun so far. Let's do corrections from the last episode.
We never make a mistake.
You know what? I don't think there were any mistakes. But, you know, in the episode before last, there was a really big mistake.
I wasn't in that.
Which,
huh?
You have to, there's a correction.
Ugh.
In the last episode that I recorded privately. Because it was a big mistake. But I guess you have to listen to the social media episode with the one with the picture of Neil Gaiman to find out what the mistake was. But I think the last episode, there were no corrections, and that's awesome. And for more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our awesome theme music is by
Adam Dean.
Yay, Adam.
And if you like the show, make sure to give us a high rating in iTunes. 5 stars makes us famous. Leave a comment. Say how much you like Adam Dean's music. That's good for everybody.
Can't arrest anyone for handing out books.
That was in Idaho, and that was with Sherman Alexie's True Diary, which I've talked about on the podcast before on other Banned Book Week shows. But that's the strategy now. That's the tactic when places ban books. The publisher usually will just send free copies to people in town to hand out.
So if you got a good book to read, let's ban it and see what we get.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
I like free books.